Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Peter Biello. And this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. As temperatures in the Granite State have heated up in recent days, so too has the legislative action at the State House. This week saw dramatic testimony from Laura Briggs, widow of Manchester police officer Michael Briggs, in opposition to a repeal of the death penalty. In electoral politics, the prospect of a Shaheen Sununu matchup has New Hampshire political observers talking, and new polling numbers show Vice President Joe Biden with a double-digit lead in a Democratic primary field that he has yet to officially join. And finally, some good news. Yes, baseball is back. Today on The Exchange, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, and we'd like to hear from you. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. You can also watch our live stream on Facebook Live. I have three guests joining me for the program this morning. Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis for Citizens Count, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization focused on civic engagement, formerly known as the Live Free or Die Alliance. And Anna, welcome back to The Exchange.
It's great to be here.
And Ethan DeWitt, Statehouse and Politics Reporter for the Concord Monitor. Ethan, thanks for joining us this morning.
Great to be here.
And Dave Solomon, Statehouse Bureau Chief for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. And Dave, thanks for coming in.
Glad to attend.
Well, there's been a tremendous amount of activity at the State House in recent days, so we have a lot to discuss. But let's start with the death penalty. We saw some dramatic testimony this week from Laura Briggs, the widow of Manchester police officer Michael Briggs, and others as well. Let's hear what Laura Briggs had to say.
It's not about an eye for an eye or revenge. It's about protecting our society from evil people.
That's Laura Briggs, wife of slain officer Michael Briggs, whose killer is the only person on death row in New Hampshire. And Anna, let me turn to you first. What's the overarching issue here on this repeal in the legislature?
Sure. So right now, New Hampshire, as you said, only has one inmate on death row. And so the repeal that's going through the legislature technically would not impact his case. But we have seen in other states when a death penalty repeal is passed that death sentences are commuted in the courts. So the issue for many people is not just will New Hampshire have a death penalty going forward, but is it going to apply to this case? However, we are seeing a lot of support for this in the legislature. I think, you know, that the Laura Briggs came out because she saw that this was really the way that it's turning. So it passed by a veto-proof majority in the House, 279-88. And the ACLU of New Hampshire predicts that it's also going to pass by a veto-proof majority in the Senate. So at this point, it doesn't matter so much that Sununu's against a repeal. It looks like this is really going to go through.
Mm-hmm. Dave, can you give us a little bit of history? I know there have been previous attempts at blocking a repeal by governors over the last 20 years or so?
The repeal has passed in the House and the Senate, but they have not been able to muster the votes to overcome the gubernatorial vetoes under both Democratic and—
Right. Gene Shaheen, I think, vetoed it in 1999.
Indeed.
2000, right around that. Yeah.
Governor Lynch presided over an expansion of the death penalty to include home invasions after the horrific crime in Mount Vernon, mm-hmm, that saw the murder of a mother and serious harm to her young daughter. So this has been a real shift in sentiment, and the testimony of the officer Riggs's wife was widow. I mean, was particularly compelling because in many ways this issue has come down to more of a question of whether the only inmate currently on death row in New Hampshire will or will not be executed, as opposed to the broader long-term policy implications of whether or not New Hampshire should have a death penalty on the books.
And on that note, Kelly Ayotte also testified at the hearing, former U.S. Senator and State Attorney General, and she had something to say on this issue of commutation.
She does not want Michael Addison to get a pass. And unfortunately, even though the legislature wrote this as going forward, that's more political cover. If they repeal this death penalty, Michael Addison's sentence will be commuted.
That's Kelly Ayotte, who was Attorney General, prosecuted Briggs' killer from an interview with WMUR, and she was also testifying at the hearing. Ethan, let me ask you, do you have a sense, and I'm also happy to hear from the rest of the panel, but we've been following this issue here at the Exchange for many years. Why do you think sentiment is changing? Why are things different now than they were, say, 10 or 20 years ago?
Well, it's kind of hard to pinpoint it to any one thing. But there have been some lawmakers that have changed for personal reasons. A lot of it, I guess a common reason that you see a lot is the idea of innocent people being accidentally executed, and then later at DNA evidence coming forward. That's sort of been a strain. But there have been all kinds of reasons. I mean, there was, we talked about this a few weeks ago on this program, the former chairman of the Criminal Justice Committee, David Welch, a staunch supporter of the death penalty for many years, changed his mind recently with the passing of his wife. And, you know, he gave a very heartfelt speech on the House floor about how he couldn't, he understands the kind of loss that losing a life entails. He didn't want to do that to anybody's family, even a family of somebody who's convicted.
Yeah,
so everybody has different reasons. I mean, yeah. And they seem to all arrive at them on a personal journey. There isn't any one broad narrative, and there isn't any one kind of, it's not a party line issue. Everybody kind of thinks independently
sure.
on this one.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem to me, Anna, that a lot of this has been driven by changes in DNA technology, and you've seen a number of governors around the country either put in a moratorium because of concerns about people being put on death row who shouldn't necessarily be there. But it also feels to me increasingly like this used to be a kind of easy issue for any conservative or Republican. This is no longer really breaking down along party lines, is it?
No, not at all. And I think it's also interesting to note that while we talk about the wrongful convictions issue is definitely driving this. I think that there are also factors. At the hearings, you'll hear people bring up cost. You'll hear families of murder victims come in.
Yeah, it'll
and
cost
say,
millions to build a,
yes,
a death row
yes,
here in New
Hampshire.
Hampshire
doesn't
we don't have
the capability
a chamber,
right
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
And also in terms of the cost of appeals. Families of murder victims coming in and testifying saying they don't want it. So we have the very vocal voice of Laura Briggs, the widow of slain Manchester police officer Michael Briggs, but we also have the voices of several other families of murder victims saying, no, we don't want this. More death is not going to make us feel better. It's not going to make us feel like justice was done.
And just to build off kind of, there are huge questions whether the death penalty stays or doesn't or is repealed in the Addison case. The big questions either way. The big question if it doesn't get repealed is what is the mechanism by which that execution might be carried out. Mm-hmm. New Hampshire right now doesn't have any drugs.
Well, I know there's been issues around the country
around
with
the
even
country,
getting access
getting
to
drugs.
Drugs.
Right.
Can't even get the drugs.
His federal appeals process, I understand, is just barely beginning, so we're years out, and there's also in the New Hampshire statute, even when his appeals exhaust, there's still a one-year buffer period after that before the execution can take place. So we're talking, probably for at least 4 years. And I don't know. I mean, but So the drug issue is a problem, but beyond that, we don't even have a set of procedures for how that might be carried out. And so that's if the death penalty stays. And if the death penalty is repealed, as I think Dave was alluding to, there has been, Democrats such as Rennie Cushing, who's been pushing for this, has emphasized that this is not a retroactive law change, that it would not affect the Addison case.
Which
there have been
disputes.
Right.
And
there
others.
Have been states right. where whatever the legislature decided, the courts have jumped in and effectively commuted those sentences themselves once the death penalty
right.
is repealed. So there are big questions, whichever way this goes, for the Michael Addison case.
So, right. Dave, I'll let you jump in, but also I would like you to talk about, just as a final comment on this, about the likelihood of an override of a Sununu veto. But go ahead. You wanted to comment?
Well, there's a definite Sununu veto coming. There's no question about it. He's been unequivocal on that. This is a huge issue for law enforcement. They turn out in large numbers at these hearings, and it does focus very largely on what they feel is appropriate justice for Officer Briggs. Almost everyone in the state is familiar with the details of the case, but it was a particularly violent murder of a police officer by Mr. Addison. He shot him point blank in the head after a crime spree, and he was already facing life in prison on other charges. So the argument is that if Addison is not sentenced to death, he'll just simply be executed, having the life sentence that he was expecting anyway, and no additional penalty for the brutal murder of a police officer. But there are many of those who testified against the death penalty, both in principle and alluding to the fact that it is possible that Briggs won't be executed. But one former attorney general, Greg Smith, pointed out that there have been 1,500 murders, capital murders, murders that would qualify for the death penalty in New Hampshire since 1930. No one has been executed. There was a police officer executed after a car theft as recently as in 1997. That man is in jail serving life in prison without parole. There's only one person that's on death row, and he happens to be a black man, and that hasn't been mentioned more than once.
Yeah, and so this sounds like this is setting us up for a very interesting override session later this year, with the assumption that Governor Sununu will veto this attempt at a repeal. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. You can email exchange at nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Let us know what you think about the top stories of the week. Let's turn to Governor Sununu's proposed Capital Infrastructure Revitalization Fund. And this fund would make one-time payments of a surplus state funds to a variety of local projects. And Ethan, you've been following this closely. What would this proposal do specifically?
Well, so this is an approach that kind of fits into this overall ethos that Governor Sununu has kind of put forward fiscally, which is he talks about this a lot, sort of the idea of one-time funds being used for one-time projects. And he kind of stepped it into high gear this year with this proposal for all of these one-off payments to towns and cities for, as the name suggests, sort of projects that are meant to kind of revitalize the local areas and, he says, sort of take the burden off of property taxes. But they kind of immediately became controversial and assailed by Democrats as earmarks. There's about $52 million dollars worth that is going, and these are projects as large as there's a $1.5 million expenditure proposed for the city of Franklin to create
In the Monitor, we read a lot about the Whitewater Park in Franklin that gets a lot of coverage.
Right, and then it goes as low as an $80,000 proposed expenditure to the city of Laconia for a kind of a skate park overhaul, and there's kind of projects big and small. Democrats have kind of two main objections to them. One of them is that they didn't go through the process of the...
They've called this an end run around the budget process.
Yeah, there is a committee that deals specifically with these types of expenditures, and it seems that the governor's office went directly to the towns and compiled this list. And the other problem that they have pointed to is that it takes this money, $52 million, which could be going towards more statewide and more kind of broad programs.
Right. And Dave, let me ask you, it seems like the governor likes these kinds of one-time payments. We've had this discussion before. What is his response to this argument that he's basically trying to skirt the budget process?
He just thinks this is the most effective way to get the money out there to where it's going to do the most good in the fastest way possible. But it's extremely unconventional This is not the way
surplus
funds have been dispensed with in the past. First of all, in recent history, the surplus hasn't been so large as to enable this kind of disbursement. Most of it usually goes into the rainy day fund. And in the first year of his administration, his first budget, I should say, there were surplus funds available and structures were set up to disperse them. A trust fund was created for school improvement. An infrastructure fund was created for municipal road projects, and there were criteria established. What are we trying to achieve with these funds? And committees were set up with various stakeholders to assess the applications from the communities as to whether they met those criteria. There was nothing like this for almost $100 million mm-hmm. that the governor basically rode around the state saying, do you need a project? Do you need a project? Okay, we'll do this one. The mayor of Berlin, standing at the governor's press conference where he was praised for all this largesse, said he just picked up the phone one day and the governor said, you know, can you get me a million-dollar project, shovel-ready, ready to go.
So there was not some sort of, okay, everyone who's interested, send us a proposal and we'll sift through them?
There was not an equal opportunity for this.
Let me hear from Anna. Anna, your thoughts?
Yeah, so, and I think it's worthwhile to note that, well, I think the concept of one-time funds for one-time projects, that does seem fiscally sound.
Yeah, we used to call it an earmark in the old days with the U.S.
Right,
Congress.
Yeah. Right, but as we're noting, there's the problem that there wasn't that review process. And it's also worth noting that there are other parts of the budget that were regular funding to towns, all towns in the state that got cut out. And people argue that's partly why we have this surplus. So if you're looking at revenue sharing, the state paying part of local retirement contributions, state aid grants for water and wastewater projects, even sharing meals and rooms tax revenue. This is all revenue that used to just go back to all of the towns equally right. that got cut back in 2010 with the recession.
Yeah. And just to kind of put it in the bigger context of what's happening with the budget. So this week and the next week are kind of the critical days for the House budget process. They plan to pass their version of, there are two budget bills in New Hampshire. One of them is kind of the line by line.
This is one and two?
Financial, yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. House bill one and two. And so yeah. the second one is kind of the policy side that enables yeah. the first one. And I think one of the potential pitfalls of the governor's approach to doing this without kind of going through the usual process of going through the committee to get these expenditures reviewed and applied for is that he kind of came up with this list and threw it at the mercy of the House budget writers. Immediately, the House the chairwoman of the House Finance Committee, Concord Representative Mary Jane Wallner, who's a very powerful person in the budget process, she and her committee immediately took those expenditures out en masse and then kind of
pulled them apart.
Well, basically kind of made it so that each one of the towns had to kind of advocate to come back in.
Oh,
and
see.
What I've heard from the governor's office yesterday is that most of those proposals did not make it into the House budget proposal.
Now, Dave, if correct me if I'm wrong, does this proposal also have the money for the secure psychiatric facility in it? Is that true?
That's in it as well.
Yes. So there's, that's something that
there's a lot of things
that
we achieve consensus on.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of it is dedicated to one-time software upgrades and plant investments to help some of the state agencies, which is pretty conventional. But it's just the opportunity for Berlin to repave its major thoroughfare, for Lebanon to have long-standing state buildings demolished, skate parks, water parks, recreational facilities. These are the things that
stuff
are sort
voters
of coloring
like.
Out of the lines, stuff voters like, and stuff that enables you to stage a press conference at which you're showered, praise is showered upon you by municipal officials for all the good you've done for their community.
And then you can go to groundbreakings and all the great stuff that goes
exactly,
along with
it's
projects.
The gift that keeps on giving politically.
Anna, let me get your final thoughts on how you think this is going to play out.
Well, there's a really important context we need to remember here, which is that the budget not only has to pass the entire House, it has to pass the entire Senate. And the Senate gets to work with updated revenue numbers, and which also means they usually have a little more money to play with. And they're going to really craft the House budget into something entirely different all over again. So what the governor submitted, personally, I think it was really more of a political play. You know, I don't think he thought a lot of these would go through because it does go through this entire process. He knew that was going to be taken out by a lot of the Democrats in the House. And so it's going to see whether this sort of blows back on them. them for, you know, cutting out local town funding, or if it's going to look as more of a sound budget process.
Mm-hmm. The bigger context is that we're likely to get a veto on the budget anyways.
But we need to take a quick break. But still to come, the prospect of a Shaheen-Sununu matchup has political observers talking. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can reach us on email, exchange at NHPR. I'm Dean Spiliotis, and this is The Exchange. We'll be right back.
I'm Jason Moon, host of the Bear Brook podcast from NHPR. Join me for a live show at the Wilbur Theater in Boston on Tuesday, May 14th. I'll speak about how we produced Bear Brook, the controversial science that helped crack open the case, and how that science is changing criminal investigations all across the country. Get your tickets now at thewilbur.com.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Dean Spiliotis, filling in for Peter Biello. On Monday, we'll be talking to Senator Maggie Hassan. If you have questions for Senator Hassan, you can email us in advance at exchange@nhpr.org. We're going to dig into some political news in a moment, but in the studio with me, I have Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, Ethan DeWitt from the Concord Monitor, he's their State House and Politics reporter, and Dave Solomon, who's the State House Bureau Chief for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. If you want to join the conversation, the number is 1-800-892-6477. You can email exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, and you can watch us on NHPR's Facebook Live stream. One more piece of, before we get to the political news, one more piece of legislative politics I want to talk about. Lots of news, seemingly somewhat suddenly, but I guess it's been going on for a while now, lots of news on gaming and casinos over the past few weeks. We have proposals for legalized sports betting. We have another proposal for two new casinos. There's been some court decisions on online lottery sales. Let's start off by listening to Lottery Commissioner Charles McIntyre at a forum on sports betting held recently at the UNH School of Law.
It's remarkable because New Hampshire is now, in large measure, the epicenter for the gambling world. It is the first state folks think of now, which is remarkable given that our size. And the fight we engaged in is not based on some hubris. It's based on a very fundamental principle that the issue of gambling has always been a state decision.
That's Lottery Commissioner Charles McIntyre speaking recently at a sports betting forum held at the UNH School of Law. And Dave Solomon, let me turn to you first. We're the epicenter of the gambling world now?
Well, New Hampshire has a long tradition of being a trailblazer. We were the first state lottery. I think they called it the sweepstakes in the 60s. And the state has that live free or die reputation. Go to New Hampshire to get your cigarettes, cheap booze, fireworks, lottery tickets have always been in the mix. So it's very consistent with, the 603 way of life. And the expansion of it continues. We added Keno last year, and this year it looks like sports betting is good to go. This is one of those rare issues this session that there's pretty much consensus on across the legislative and executive branch.
Now, for our listeners, is this fantasy sports or is this literally betting on pro sports?
No, I'm sorry. This is legal sports betting.
So we're not even talking just like the fantasy online stuff. We're talking betting on baseball, football.
The spread between a Patriots and Jets game and with an online component. I mean, the plan is to set up about 12 betting parlors, 10 betting parlors in the state, and an online component for the Lottery Commission as well. Sununu already has $10 million in anticipated revenue from this in his budget, and there's not even a law for him to sign yet. He called on lawmakers to go all in on this, and the House passed it by a huge margin, 269-82. About 2 weeks ago, it'll go into the budget negotiations with the Senate and is likely to come through. The big question in all of this is if a change of federal policy regarding internet gambling across state lines will have an effect on this plan or on the state's sale of lottery tickets.
Do we have any sense of what kind of financial windfall we're talking about here for the state? Have they given any figures?
On sports gambling?
Yes.
Yeah, $10
million. $10 million. Okay.
That's what Sununu's put in his budget for 2020.
Yeah, and Anna, let me turn to you. We also have a casino bill that popped up somewhat unexpectedly in the Senate, although Senator Lou D'Alessandro, who's been a champion of setting up these two casinos, was driving this one as well, I believe. And I remember that for Governor Hassan, we had a big debate over these casinos. What's going on here?
Sure. So, as you said, Senator Lou D'Alessandro has been sponsoring casino bills for years and years and years and years. And the casinos have gone through the Senate more than once, but they always get stopped in the House, really. So I think that there's definitely an uphill battle in the House. And I'm not sure that there's really an appetite for it this year in the same way, because there are a lot of concerns about market saturation. You know, some casinos in Connecticut and the one that's opening in Massachusetts are seeing revenue below expectations. And so there's really the argument, would we be getting as much bang for the buck with this as we are with sports betting, which is really bipartisan support at this point.
There was a sense, I went to one of the hearings in the Senate, and there was a sense from both sides, even the lobbyists for the casinos, that they had kind of missed their prime, that before that Massachusetts casino was set up, when Governor Hassan was pushing for this in 2013, that fell short. But that was the time to strike, because that was the time when we could have created, been a real force in the market. So, you talk to D'Alessandro and he says that there's still plenty of interest. A lot of people say, I'm not sure what the reasons are for this, but the Northeast is of the United States is particularly prone to kind of gambling and to betting and that type of activity. So there is some hope that that's still viable. And the revenue estimates for these casinos, if they are set up, the rosy estimates, if they're set up quickly, by 2023, they could bring in $135 million and $194 million by 2024, according to the Lottery Commission. That is a lot of revenue. I mean, that's a game changer for the state in terms of funding. But then, obviously, there are other questions.
And Dave, you mentioned the issue of online lottery sales, and we had this recent DOJ, Department of Justice, opinion saying reversing some or changing some earlier regulation about it being illegal. I think New Hampshire's now filed a suit to reverse that. Can you say a little bit about this issue of online lottery ticket sales?
Yeah, the Justice Department in 2011 issued guidance saying the only concern it had about interstate gambling on the internet centered around sports betting, the kind of which we're now looking
right
at in terms of setting up parlors in state. And so the state started selling lottery tickets online to residents of other states, and we're looking at doing this with sports betting and fantasy sports. And for some reason, fairly recently, the Trump Justice Department reversed course and said it views any internet gambling across state lines as a violation of the Federal Wire Act. Mm-hmm. And New Hampshire and other states have filed suit over this, claiming it will cost hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue over
time. It's a big loss
of,
if they were to take that away, it'd be a big loss of revenue.
Exactly. So we're waiting to see how that plays out.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I have three guests with me in studio today: Dave Solomon of the Union Leader, Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor, and Anna Brown of Citizens Count. You can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. Emails exchange at nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, and you can watch us on Facebook Live as well. And we'll continue to follow all of this casino and gaming developments over at the State House. But let's turn our attention now to electoral politics. There's been some reporting, John DeStazo at WMUR and some others I've heard as well, that Governor Sununu is now taking a serious look, or at least a more serious look, at challenging Jeanne Shaheen in 2020, which for politicos like me really got me thinking and got a lot of us talking. Let me start with you, Anna. This is a bit of a change for him. I mean, he talked about being a manager and how he wouldn't want another job. This is what he does. What's changing here? What has changed here to make him do this now?
Well, he made some comments after some recent polling data that showed he was basically in a dead heat with Shaheen, if there was a theoretical match.
There were two polls, and he was either a dead heat or a couple behind.
Yeah,
right?
Within the margin of error such that, you know, it could go either way. So he said, you know, this shows that the people want someone other than Shaheen because I haven't even said I'm running, and they'd go for me. And so I think that everyone has been sort of looking at Shaheen and Sununu and thinking it's the obvious matchup. But he's been playing possum, kind of. He said, you know, I'm governor of New Hampshire. That's it. He was running for re-election in 2018. That's all he'd talk about. I think this polling data, suddenly it's popped up. And this is the first time he's said, well, yeah, maybe I will run because look at these polls. Clearly I could do okay.
What's your gut on this? Do you think you have a sense of how he's leaning or not yet?
That's hard to say. Sure. I mean, these were pretty strong words right out of the gate. You know, so I think it's looking good. I'm also thinking that he's seeing some pretty significant challenges coming for him as governor next time around. I think the Democrats are kind of already running their gubernatorial campaign, setting it up even just in the first year of the legislature. If we're looking at the showdown on family and medical leave, Senator Dan Feltes has been very vocal. So, you know, maybe he's looking, all right, this is going to be the prime time for me to kind of move past to the next step, past the governor's office.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what kind of get a peek of what the Republican Party is thinking here, because not only is obviously they're going to need to be the fundraising apparatus is going to need to get geared up pretty soon. I mean,
Governor Sununu is not a big fan of fundraising, has had some issues in the
personally
past.
He's not, so that's another interesting thing. But I mean, just looking at the the last Senate election in 2016 was one of the most expensive ones in the country at that time, and at the it was that Senate seat was sort of seen at the time as sort of pivotal for control of the U.S. Senate. But so there's that aspect of it. There's also just sort of like who fills in the gaps for a gubernatorial nominee for the Republicans as well, and kind of what the Sununu's legacy wants to be, and kind of how, you know, how the winds are blowing in terms of 2020 majorities for either continued majorities for Democrats or maybe a flip for Republicans. These are all factors that are, I'm sure, are kind of spinning around. It's beyond just sort of one man's ambition.
And Dan, I'm sorry, Dave, I've talked to a number of people about this informally, and what I keep hearing is that if he were to do this, he would face a national vetting, particularly by outside groups, that he hasn't yet experienced in running for governor, that running for the U.S. Senate nowadays brings in the rest of the country to look at you as a candidate.
Well, especially a high-profile Senate race involving a senator who—
A family rematch.
A family rematch against the two biggest political machines in the state. It's been known for at least a month now that Sununu had walked away from his pledge that he would not seek the Senate seat that he had voiced on several occasions in the past. What's relatively new is that he's expected to make some announcement in the near future, and that would be because the Republican Party deserves to know if it's going to need to field another candidate for governor in the near future, and people need to start getting organized along those lines. He will be subject to a lot of national scrutiny that he's has not been familiar with up to this point. And you can bet that all of the video of him saying, I love New Hampshire, I want to stay in New Hampshire, I want to work for the people of New Hampshire, I have no interest in going down there and being part of that mess in Washington, we're going to be seeing a lot of that video if there is a Sununu-Shaheen campaign.
Anna, when I talk to people about this issue of, well, if he runs for senator, that opens up, because we have a two-year cycle for everything. He can't run for both. I always hear from people, oh, we're going to have either Kelly Ayotte versus Dan Feltes or Andrew Walensky as a marquee governor's race. What do you think?
Yes. Andrew Walensky has definitely been seen as a possible Democratic candidate. Also worth throwing out there, though, on the Republican side, I think Bill O'Brien, we need to put
his
name out there.
That's right. He has mentioned as well, right? Former
he's mentioned it.
Conservative
he came in with the
Tea Party.
Yeah, Speaker of the House in New Hampshire. He came in with the Tea Party movement. And he also ran briefly for the U.S. House in 2014. He dropped out before the primary. So he's been talking about that a little bit. I would say that would definitely be a very much more polarized campaign, whether he was running against Shaheen because Sununu decided to stay in the governor office, or if he decides to step up for governor. He's definitely a lot more conservative, like I said, Tea Party wing, as opposed to Sununu. And so that could put a different spin on politics in New Hampshire
This race has certainly got the people in my world salivating, both for what it would mean for the Senate race and for the governor's race. But we also, of course, are focused on the presidential primary here at The Exchange. And there's a new new national poll. It's not a New Hampshire poll, but it's a national poll out from Quinnipiac University that's getting a lot of coverage for the Democratic presidential primary. And it shows Joe Biden, who's not officially in the race yet, but sounds like he's about to pull the trigger in April and has been kind of putting out feelers here in the state, has him with a double-digit lead, as Biden at 29%, Sanders at 19, Beto O'Rourke at 12, Harris at Kamala Harris at 8, and Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg at 4%. Any insight in this? I'd like to hear from all of you, but let me start with you, Dave. Does this mean anything for how we think of New Hampshire?
Well, at this point in the primary over the years, this early, the front runners in the polls have historically been those that have had the most name recognition, particularly if they've held the office of vice president in a previous administration. So Biden's position is not a surprise, but it's not necessarily an indication of where he'll be at this time next year. He has certainly got most of the name recognition. He's got an engaging personality. A lot of the goofiness of his tenure as vice president appears to have been not elevated in the minds of voters at this time, although it's clear that President Trump would make a lot of that should he eventually get the nomination.
And Ethan, it has New Hampshire polling has Biden and Sanders closer, and Elizabeth Warren had been up pretty high for a while, but she seems to have receded a little bit. And I hear from people watching New Hampshire who say, well, you know, Sanders won last time. He's from Vermont. Warren is from Massachusetts. They've got to do well here, otherwise they're done. Do you buy that analysis?
I think there's certain truth to that, but I also think, again, it's really hard to weed out, as Dave was saying, what is name recognition, what is kind of local preference for this early,
and we haven't seen
that
head to head yet either.
Yeah, and when you talk about untested candidacies, I mean, Biden has a long record for better or for worse. The country has also changed significantly since. He was last in the spotlight as a vice presidential candidate. And, we haven't really seen – he hasn't been tested in the way in kind of 2019 America yet. And so I think that may change things. It may not. It's just kind of too early.
Anna, your thoughts?
Sure. I think that, as we've discussed, it's all about name recognition at this point. So I would say it's almost more concerning to the people who we didn't even mention show up in the poll, but were included in the poll. So, the Julian Castros, the Tulsi Gabbards, the Cory Booker, people who have been, there's a lot of noise about them, and they still
aren't bubbling
up. Booker's
put a lot of effort into the state so far.
A lot of effort. And so I think two other things that are worth mentioning. Pete Buttigieg is a mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and he's coming in at the top of this poll.
Yeah, he'll be here next weekend, not this weekend, but next week.
Yeah, and so that's really interesting that he's being able to bubble up like that. For listeners who might not know him, his website describes himself as a millennial mayor, Afghanistan war veteran, and husband. He is making history as the first openly gay candidate for president. Mm. So he's kind of interesting. But the other thing that I have found personally interesting about this race so far is everyone's talking about Biden. Go back a decade or so, everyone was talking about all of Biden's gaffes, having foot and mouth disease.
His previous runs for president prior to being vice president were not necessarily strong showings.
Absolutely. One of my funniest stories I think about him is when he told Chuck Graham, he's here. Stand up, Chuck. Let him see it. Well, Chuck Graham is confined to a wheelchair.
He was in a wheelchair. That's
so,
a famous clip. Yeah.
He says things like that. And it seems like people kind of in light of Trump, who has said many outrageous things that have caused a lot of controversy. It seems everyone seems to have forgotten that Joe Biden used to be the butt of more of those jokes.
But I wonder also, and this is just purely speculative, I mean, the gaffes of the past were kind of more gaffes in the sense of that you think of in terms of political gaffes, like goofy.
Goofy. No.
There's a little bit of a change in tenor now when it comes to what are gaffes and kind of, post or
the nature of the
Me
discourse
movement.
The environment
right.
has changed.
When you look at, for instance, the Anita Hill stuff, that's sort of come back to him in a way that 10 years ago, maybe that wasn't really seen as a gaffe. I mean, misspeaking was one thing. This time around, some of the baggage for all the candidates is taking a little bit of a heavier tone.
And Dave, real quick, what's interesting to me is, for many years, running for president from the Senate or the U.S. House was viewed as extremely difficult because you have these long records of votes and statements and other kinds of things that are problematic. It does not seem to be deterring people this time.
Not at all. Well, some of them are so fairly new and don't have lengthy records. And Senate has always been a big launching board for the presidency, though. And governors have records that they have to run on as well. So I don't think, unless you're completely absent any legislative record, as Donald Trump did. It's rare that we have a candidate with such a blank slate on the political record.
Well, we do need to take one more break, but coming up, we're going to look at some national issues dealing with court cases that may have an impact on New Hampshire. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Dean Spiliotis, and we'll be right back.
So choosing NHPR was a rather easy decision for us.
NHPR underwriter Dan Weed of Weed Family Automotive.
I think it comes down to the roots of what you're doing and the community that you're in. So NHPR is a core part of that community. It's local, it's small business, family oriented. So I think NHPR is a great place to be.
To learn more about joining NHPR's growing family of underwriters, go to nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. On Monday, we'll be talking with Senator Maggie Hassan. If you have questions for Senator Hassan, you can email us in advance at exchange@nhpr.org. And I'm Dean Spiliotis, filling in for Peter Biello. And I'm here with Dave Solomon, New Hampshire State House reporter at the Union Leader, Ethan DeWitt, Concord Monitor, State House and Politics reporter, and Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count. And folks, right before the break, we were talking about a little before the break, we were talking about a potential Shaheen Sununu challenge and what that might mean for a governor's race. And we had an email from Christopher in Manchester who said a Valinsky versus O'Brien race would be a turnoff for most folks in the middle, a far left Democrat versus a far right Republican. Shaheen, Lynch, Hassan, and Sununu all won by hitting the sweet spot in our purple state. That matchup would be the perfect opportunity for a third party candidate if ever there was one. I assume he means Valinsky against O'Brien would open it up. But there is some truth to that, Anna, that we'd have an interesting battle for the center, the independent center of the state, between a Sununu and a Shaheen candidacy.
Yes, absolutely. I think that here's the interesting thing. If we're looking at Sununu, Hassan, Shaheen, Lynch, most of them, you know, we're talking they had to rule under divided government. They've put through policies that maybe didn't match their personal views on everything. You know, Sununu has been okay with Medicaid expansion. Lynch signed a budget that had huge budget cuts in it, including for the university. And so, yeah, a Valinsky versus O'Brien race would be a change in tone. It would be much more polarized than pretty much any election I can remember in recent history for the governor. And it's interesting because recently I've been looking at political polarization and partisanship in the New Hampshire House and Senate. And the New Hampshire House is definitely on an upward swing. If you look at the past 20 years, they're at an almost all-time high. The Senate stays pretty even. So the question is this partisanship in the House going to start leaking over to the other branches?
And the governor, they've been that position has sort of been defying gravity for so long. Past governors have had very high approval ratings compared to any politician around the country, and Sununu is no exception. You know, if you start getting into the far, corners of both parties, I wonder if that could hold, above 50%.
One more political story that could affect future elections, and Dave Solomon, I'll turn to you. The state legislature has now passed, I think, one in the House and one in the Senate, two different versions of an independent redistricting commission. What's this all about?
This stems from a desire on the part of many people in politics and in the general electorate to discourage, if not prevent, or at least mitigate the practice of gerrymandering, in which the party in power, with the majority in the state legislature, in the year after a decennial census, every 10 years, the population is assessed. We find out how many people are living in each parts of the state, and the legislature gets to redraw the districts for everything from state rep to state senator to U.S. Congress,
levels,
U.S. senator, right down the line. And the practice pretty much universally has been the party in power has tried to draw those lines to benefit and sustain their majority.
This is the old, to the victors go,
go the spoils.
Yes.
And so the districts are drawn so that if it's the Republicans drawing them, they chop off little pieces of the Democratic base and disperse it among larger rural Republican districts so as to minimize the likelihood of a Democratic success, or give the Democrats a few districts by clustering all their voters together. And this has caused voters to think that seats are just locked in. My representative doesn't really have to work for my vote. He knows he's going to get it. The politicians are choosing their voters instead of the other way around. The argument against that is that the Constitution says the legislature gets to draw the districts. And if you want to change that, you need to amend the Constitution, not pass a law that says we'll create a commission of nonpartisans, if you can find any, to draw the districts. And then the legislature has to pass the plan.
That's how they get that's how they respond to the constitutionality issue.
The legislature has to sign off on it. They can't change it and they can't amend it. And so the Republicans say,
it's interesting, as a sort of kind of in the weeds comparison, the process for choosing these commissioners or the people who serve in this commission is vastly different. I don't really know which one is better, but I believe the House one, correct me if I'm wrong, the House one, if I remember, had the Secretary of State kind of nominated 45 potential people. Mm. I think 15 from like one party, 15 from another party, and 15 who are undeclared or independent. And then there's a randomization process within those 15, and it kind of narrows it down. The Senate proposal allows each of the party leaders in the House and Senate, the minority and majority, mm-hmm. In both, to each appoint one. So there's four people, and then those four have to then decide on the other three. And that's sort of at, you know, just speaking, this is a minor point in the bigger picture, but you know, the idea of impartiality for this commission is critical for to have public support.
And Anna, let me turn to you. Bigger picture here, I know, I think something like 34 to 36 states, I don't remember the exact number, still do this to the victor goes the spoils. But we are seeing some movement around the country to move away from that. What's your prognosis for this going forward? Do you think that we're going to see this happen here, or is this part of a larger trend? Or is it still primarily, if you're the party in power, you get to draw the lines?
Yeah, I think this is not quite ready for, or it's not going to pass in New Hampshire right now, because we know that Sununu is against this. He released a statement earlier this year that he likes the fact that the courts kind of get to police what the legislature is doing, and he thinks that's good enough. And it doesn't look like the House and Senate have enough to override that veto. Interesting, though, is that there is also a constitutional amendment that the House has that would change this in the Constitution to have an independent redistricting commission. And
that's a much bigger process.
It's a much bigger process. So they're holding that back in committee over the summer. So I think they're going to kind of see how these bills play this out this year. And then they might come back next year and say, all right, let's do it. Let's do the full constitutional amendment. And that way that works is it would need to get ratified by the public. So that would end up on your 2020 ballot.
And just to speak to the governor's position that the courts kind of work this out well. I certainly wasn't a reporter in 2001, 2002. I think a lot of people in that time would disagree that the courts kind of carried out well. The courts, the Supreme Court intervened after they drew its own districts and kind of managed to make everybody mad. There were all kinds of lawsuits, counter lawsuits. Mm-hmm. To contrast that position with his position, for instance, on school funding, where he's been adamant against, the Claremont decisions in terms of the courts kind of drawing up how school funding should be allocated. It's a little bit inconsistent in terms of whether the Supreme Court should jump into state policy. Mm-hmm.
It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, and you can watch us on Facebook Live. I'm here with Anna Brown, Ethan DeWitt, and Dave Solomon talking about the top stories of the week. And let's turn our attention now outside of New Hampshire for a moment to look at a a trio of court decisions that could have a significant impact on the Granite State. There's that decision in Kentucky blocking Medicaid work requirements that follows up with some earlier issues with Arkansas's work requirements. There's the Trump administration's decision to no longer defend the Affordable Care Act in court. And in Oklahoma, we also saw a settlement with the big pharma, Purdue, the makers of OxyContin, for, I think, $270 million. So let's take a moment and look at the impact of each of those in New Hampshire. And, Dave, let me start with you. Let's talk about the Medicaid work requirement seems to be the most pressing in some sense for New Hampshire. We're seeing legislative action. We had the compromise last year. What's the potential impact here?
Well, it has a lot of impact in the Medicaid program, which we can get to. It's also had a huge impact on the political dynamic at the State House. As Anna pointed out, the polarization in the House has been growing. The Senate has always tried to present itself as more congenial and not bipartisan, and in many ways has been. But this issue of the Medicaid work requirement, the requirement for the expanded population in Medicaid, has really been divisive and does have the potential to cause perhaps long-term damage to the collegiality in the Senate. The debate on that last night was particularly vociferous, with Republicans basically accusing the Democrats of a double cross, mm-hmm. saying we didn't want to vote for Medicaid expansion. Most Republican legislatures didn't. Right. It was part of Obamacare to extend the number of people who had insurance under Medicaid. Yeah. We only went along with it after you agreed to put in a work requirement. Now that you have the majority, you want to take the work requirement away. Yeah. We will never be able to bargain with you again in good faith.
And I will mention to listeners, if you go back in the Exchange archive several weeks, there was a show on this issue, I think, with Dan Feltes and
Jeb Bradley,
very tense on this issue. And Anna, let me turn to you. What are the concerns here about these work rules? I know New Hampshire's trying to scale them back, but there have been workability problems both in Arkansas and Kentucky as well.
Yes, yes. So the problem a lot of times is not necessarily in what they're requiring people to do, but not informing people how they file, what they qualify for, what they don't qualify for. And so, for example, if you're looking at these states, they're losing, 18,000 people are getting disenrolled, and many of them probably would be eligible. So it's that question of, can this be implemented in a way that is really fair and legal and not discriminatory? If there are, what are the resources that we're going to outreach and stuff like that? I think it is worth noting that there is a difference between what the House and the Senate are doing on this. The House was looking to get rid of all work requirements altogether, whereas the Senate, what they put through, modifies those requirements. So, example, instead of saying that parents are exempt if they have children up to age 6, they're saying, okay, well, now it's up to kids age 13. They're sort of trying to limit it, but not necessarily throw it out the window altogether. Of course, as you noted, Republicans say, no, you're going back on your word. But the debate is sort of in the margins there in the Senate.
And just to put in the context of the decisions this week, those decisions, as I understand them, which applied to Arkansas, which is the first state to implement a work requirement, and I think it might be the only one to actually have it in effect, and Kentucky,
I believe so.
Yeah, and Kentucky, which has it on the books but hasn't yet enacted it. Those decisions did not actually turn on the details of within the work requirement, but rather the process by which the federal agency, CMS, approved the waivers from the states to allow these work requirements. And that's significant because, lawyers who are right now, there was a lawsuit last week against the federal government on New Hampshire's behalf to end New Hampshire's program. They say that the exact same process was carried out. And so they say because it's before the same court and because CMS, the federal agency, uses the same process for all of these states that's been approving these waivers, it doesn't matter what you do in the New Hampshire legislature to change what this work requirement looks like. The approval was flawed from the beginning, according to this district court. And that means that at least for the short term, it seems very likely that New Hampshire's work requirement will be vacated the same way as the other states if the same
same legal rationale is used. The question after that is what are the next steps? There are a few things that the federal agency can do. It could appeal it, which it may do, or it could try to rework, which it already has tried to do in the case of Kentucky. It could try to rework these waivers and try to.
Dave, I want to make sure we talk about these other court decisions as well. This unconstitutionality of Obamacare, this appeals court decision, the Trump administration, the DOJ has said they're no longer going to defend it. New Hampshire is in the process of trying to backstop this with some state legislation. Could you say something briefly about that?
That's not a very popular ruling in New Hampshire at all. Even Governor Sununu came out strongly against not only the ruling, but the decision by the Trump administration to support the ruling to eliminate Obamacare and to pursue it as far through the courts as it can, all the way to the Supreme Court, because the state has benefited a great deal through the expansion of Medicaid, as the governor himself has said, and they're very determined to oppose this or mitigate against it in any way they can. The Senate passed a bill yesterday that would enshrine in New Hampshire law the essential provisions of Obamacare, such as protections for pre-existing conditions and basic health benefits required in all policies, so that if Obamacare is repealed at the national level, no insurance company could sell health insurance in New Hampshire that didn't at least offer the key provisions of what had been known as Obamacare. But we're a long way from that happening.
Yeah, and I just to note just how the political winds have changed. That vote was 23-1. I was honestly expecting a lot more of the. So one senator, Senator John Reagan, said that we should not be tying down insurance policies with mandates for coverage, mandates for not discriminating against people with pre-existing conditions and the so-called essential health benefits. We shouldn't be telling companies to do that. If you were to rewind back 10 years, that was a very common Republican position, that this is flawed, and it was sort of part of the opposition to the ACA. Now in 2019, that everything is set in stone, you have almost every single Republican senator went along with not only supporting the ACA, but putting it into New Hampshire state law. And I think that's significant.
Yeah, and Anna, real quick, I want to just touch briefly on that third court decision. It's not a decision of settlement in the OxyContin Purdue Pharma. This is just the beginning of many lawsuits, and New Hampshire's involved in a number of them.
Yes. So, thousands of lawsuits actually that we're talking that are pending against Purdue Pharma. And so recently they settled, they're going to pay $270 million to fund addiction research and treatment in Oklahoma. And so New Hampshire has filed similar lawsuits related to trying to get these pharmaceutical companies to pay to cover what we are experiencing with the addiction crisis in New Hampshire. And so people are looking at this as something similar to, if we're looking at the MTBE settlement, so that when there was an additive in gasoline that ended up polluting a lot of water, New Hampshire ended up getting a lot of money out of that lawsuit, which it is now using for cleaning up water. And also you go back, the Master Tobacco settlement, the lawsuit against tobacco companies, New Hampshire gets a significant chunk of its budget from those settlement funds. So there's the question, this could be significant money coming in for New Hampshire in the future.
Mm. Mm-hmm. The question is, will they use it for drug services and treatment, unlike the tobacco fund, very little of which is actually being used for tobacco prevention?
I want to mention real quick on our earlier discussion on gambling, we had an email, a late email from Rebecca, who wanted to point out that the discussion did not include the consequences associated with gambling disorders, addiction, the impact on families and communities, and she hopes that the governor does not turn a blind eye to that. We also want to mention in the news this week, a group of, I believe, 30 Jordan's Furniture employees in Nashua hit a jackpot of sorts, $1 million in Powerball. That's about $33,000 each before taxes. So I'm sure they're spending time thinking about what they're going to do with that. There was a single winning ticket in Wisconsin for the $750 million decision, a ticket, which is about a $400 million payout. And finally, last night, season opener for the Red Sox. Unfortunately, they lost 12-4 to the Seattle Mariners. We'll see if we can repeat last year's remarkable season. But we are out of time for this week. I want to thank all of my guests, Dave Solomon of the New Hampshire Union and New Hampshire Union Leader in Sunday News. Thank you so much. Good to see you.
Help.
And Ethan DeWitt, Concord Monitor's State House and Politics reporter. Ethan, always good to see you.
Great to be on.
And Anna Brown, who is Director of Research at Citizens Count. Anna, it's always great to see you, too.
Always a great conversation, Dean.
This is The Exchange. It's a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our NHPR fellow is Ali Oshinsky. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Peter Biello.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.